Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and today we're going to go back into looking at the origins of fascism. Now, if you want to start from the start with this, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, I did the origins of fascism part one, and we're looking at the works of Roger Eatwell on fascism. Roger Eatwell is still writing at the moment, has written some very important works recently about the global trend towards far-right populism, as we can see in Trump and other unpleasant phenomena around the world. So, yes, check out his work. It's well worth examining. Now, previously, when we talked about the development of fascism, we talked about its kind of historical antecedent and sort of collaborative ideology, nationalism. Now, nationalism as an ideology is a problematic concept because there are all manner of different nationalisms. There are liberal nationalisms, conservative nationalisms, and racist nationalisms. If you go back to look at the 1848 revolutions across Europe, these are largely liberal revolutions. The meeting of liberalism and nationalism was that liberals that wanted the establishment of democratic rules of and constitutional rules of law that were not decided by monarchist autocracies, believed that the nation state was the vessel which would contain these progressive developments, that if a German or an Italian nation state was founded, then it could be founded, as it was being founded, a constitution could be written that would enshrine the rights of citizens as a result. So this was a notion of nationalism as a kind of a tool, a Trojan horse for progressive values, and that the nation as a kind of a neutral entity could be whatever people wanted it to be, or whatever liberal revolutionaries wanted it to be. As a result, conservatives like Bismarck were highly sceptical of nationalism. They saw it as a highly dubious thing. And Bismarck in the 1860s has his conversion to nationalism, where he suddenly realises that it can be captured for conservative ends, for keeping the Prussian aristocracy at the top and the poor where they belong, the rising or working classes and the German peasantry. And the fact that there was the beginnings of an industrial revolution and the development of a proletariat in Germany, and people such as in 1847, Karl Marx writing the Communist Manifesto, saying, well, revolution, this, the spectre of revolution is haunting Europe. People, various kind of conservative ideologues said, yeah, this Marx guy's got a point. We need something that will capture the plebeian and that will capture the working classes And nationalism, patriotism, belief in the nation, belief in identity behind the flag and behind the glory of one's own imagined past. This is how you do it. And this is how nationalism shifts in the 19th century towards the right. And this is an important part of the development of fascism.
So Roger Eatwell writes, This holistic nationalism was highly critical of liberal universalism, a feature which contributed to the rise of a new racism. Hostility to outsiders has existed since prehistoric times, and ancient Greek philosophy had demonised the barbarian other. What emerged during the late 19th century was a more developed, systematic form of racial thinking. Two names stand out in this development: the French aristocrat Arthur de Gobineau and the Englishman Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who in later life adopted German citizenship and became an admirer of a rising young politician named Adolf Hitler. Gobineau's key work was his essay on the inequality of the human races, written in the 1850s, but little read until the 1870s. He saw the world as polarised between white, yellow and black races, Caucasian, Mongoloid, Negroid, and argued that the motor of history was the struggle between these races. Chamberlain was deeply influenced by the nationalism of the composer Richard Wagner, who became his father-in-law. His Foundations of the 19th Century, published in 1900, was widely read, or more precisely, sold and talked about. Its seminal importance to the emergence of fascism, however, lies in more than its influence. It is also related to its style, for Chamberlain's arguments were not simply based on Wagnerian historical or mystical notions. He synthesised these ideas with a growing body of scientific and intellectual developments and rejected the pessimism of Gobineau. So, here we have the meetings of extreme romanticised nationalism and racial thinking, or for want of a better word, racial science. Now, without getting into a complex discussion about what a science is, one can certainly argue that eugenics and racial so-called science isn't scientific at all. Science is a peer-reviewed system of knowledge that requires or relies upon hypothesis, testing and repeatable results. There's essentially none of that in racial thinking. Racial thinking starts with the prejudicial assumption. And racial thinking works in the opposite of a defined system of knowledge. Racial thinking starts with the prejudice and then selects the evidence to support it, editing out anything which challenges the beliefs. So taxonomies of race based on intelligence or physical strength are, of course, as any rational person knows, largely meaningless. And those like Gobineau or Chamberlain or later Hitler, who advocated them, had basically no scientific base upon which to work. And so one cannot call racial thinking scientific. There are racial arguments, flawed and essentially based in bigotry and prejudice, certainly, just because they are weak or flawed arguments doesn't mean to say that there are those that don't consider them arguments at all. But they are not based in any kind of meaningful science. Now, the interesting thing for our purposes, when we're looking at the works of Gobineau and Chamberlain, is that they lay down the kind of many of the founding ideas are later on Nazism, that specifically racialized variant of European fascism. Hitler in Mein Kampf has virtually no new ideas. Every idea from the notion of the leader, the Führer figure, all the way through to there being a racial hierarchy, all the way through to the idea that Gobineau put forward, that the primary driver in history was racial struggle. These were not original ideas by Hitler. Hitler
is often thought of being, by his admirers or his detractors, an original thinker. He's certainly not. His entire repertoire of fascist ideas are cherry-picked from racist thinkers in the mid-19th century. So, in this period, sort of the mid-century, we have this kind of intersection between radical romantic nationalism and racial thinking. And, of course, it is the discoveries of Charles Darwin which are used and abused by racial thinkers that adds kind of a great deal of energy to these sorts of discourses. Roger Ewell writes, "Arguably the most important 19th century scientific development in its impact on political ideology was Darwinism. Charles Darwin published The Origin of the Species in 1859. Others quickly realised that some of the key ideas, especially survival of the fittest and natural selection, could be adapted for political ends, though there were disagreements over what their implications were. In one version, Darwinism seemed to point to the need for minimal state intervention to allow free competition. In another, Darwinism was taken as highlighting the need for the state to take on the role of selection to ensure the survival, especially in the battle with less developed but virile and martial races." So here you have the seeds of Darwinism within classical economic liberal thought, the idea that individuals, businesses, are actors within an economy and need to be left to either thrive or fail. And those that fail essentially are editing themselves out of economic activity, and this is an entirely good thing. And that state assistance simply encourages the weaklings to thrive and creates a sluggish economy. This kind of economic liberalism of the 19th century re-emerges in Britain and America and then across the rest of the world from the 1970s onwards in the guise of neoliberalism or monetarism as it was understood then. The other perspective is the idea that the state should intervene in order to ensure that some kind of racial or genetic selection happens. Now, even in supposedly liberal states like Britain and France, eugenics movements emerged in the 19th century and in the 20th century, particularly after the First World War. Some of the greatest intellectual luminaries of the age, from the Huxleys through to the sexual health campaigner Marie Stopes in Britain, were advocates of a kind of like a class-based eugenics, encouraging working class people to have fewer children because they had they posed the threat in the eyes of the Bloomsbury types and Fabians that they would outbreed the bourgeoisie. There's a very
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A detailed argument of this in Richard Overy's The Morbid Age, which is always well worth reading. I always advocate that book on this podcast. And so eugenics, particularly, was not seen as really, you know, a dirty word until after the discoveries of the death camps in Nazi Germany and occupied Europe after the Second World War. It seemed perfectly natural that the state should have a role in improving not just in marginalising racial minorities, but in improving the stock of the kind of the racial majority overall, encouraging those with better genes to breed and those who were inferior to have fewer or hopefully no children. Statist racism, as you can call eugenics, was pioneered by leading scientists throughout Europe in the 19th century, one being the German scientist Ernst Haeckel. The eugenicists were worried about the way that moral laws prevented the workings of natural selection. So their view, which I think was perhaps shaped in some part by Nietzschean ideas, was that Christianity itself had caused societies to become sluggish, societies to become overtly kind of sentimental and protective towards weaker genes, and that human morality was at odds with the demands of nature and the workings of nature, and that there needed now to be a regeneration or a rejuvenation of national or even European racial stock. When, if you imagine the worldview of the bourgeois eugenicist of the 19th century, not only looking at inferior peoples, in inverted commas, within Europe's empires in Africa and Asia, and seeing birth rates far higher, and worrying whether white Europeans and their white European civilization might be eventually be outbred, but also looking at the environment around them in the heart of Europe's Industrial Revolution, looking at the numerous but often sickly and underfed and seemingly degenerate, there's this term that keeps coming up time and time in racial thinking throughout the 19th century, degenerate, degenerate working classes of the European cities, infused with the kind of, I suppose, the arrogance of colonialism and the ideology of class. It is quite easy to see how they came to the conclusion that only that removing impediments to natural selection was the logical way to go. However, statist racism goes one step further, and it places the eugenicist as the selector. And finally, when you reach the kind of the height of this creed in the T4 action program in Nazi Germany, the doctor becomes the figure who has responsibility for not treating the individual patient. The Hippocratic Oath demands that one does no harm. German SS doctors viewed their role in the T4 program as treating the racial body. Germany itself was the patient, and that it needed to, and the racial body itself needed to be improved, and the interventions needed to be made, principally mass murder in the T4 action. Another intellectual trend of the late 19th century, which became another core component of fascist thought, was the idea of elite theory. So by 1914, across Europe, and largely independent of one another, Sociologists, particularly the Italian sociologist Vilfredo Pareto and the German sociologist, Robert Michels, who had become an Italian citizen, believed that societies necessarily had to have elites and they needed to be ruled by them. And societies without elites did not function. And the this notion becomes a kind of an article of faith in fascist thought as the idea of the leader, of the charismatic leader who is the only individual capable of making sense of an increasingly complex world, emerges. The argument was that major differences between the forms of governments were simply the social composition of elites and the extent to which they were open to talent from rising social groups. But that the core similarity was that they were all run by elites by and large. You had more autocratic societies such as Russia, which were entirely exclusionary of any kind of social mobility, or you had more meritocratic, more open societies such as Britain, where it was possible for there to be a degree of social mobility for non-aristocrats to wind up as, say, for example, Prime Minister, to take for a obvious example of David Lloyd George. However, the idea that societies can function without elites and they could function without elite leadership was considered an anathema to the entire school of thought. The next development that shaped fascist thinking comes from psychology. The main intellectual figure here being Sigmund Freud, who had argued in his works that an unconscious mind, unconscious drives exist. And this pointed towards the belief that human beings were fundamentally irrational. This undermined the Enlightenment idea that human beings were rational actors, particularly when it came to voting and elections and could make conscious and sensible choices and decisions about the kind of government that they should have. A significant contributor to the argument of the irrational human was Gustave Le Bon, who wrote in 1895 The Psychology of Crowds. And this depicted human beings as an emotive mass, firstly that needed to be controlled, but in as far as fascist thinking went, that could be manipulated. The idea of the kind of the mass psychology of fascism, that is, if you look at the rather crazy writings of Wilhelm Reich, and then the more rational writings of Erich Fromm in his book The Fear of Freedom, published in 1940. These both take psychoanalytical approaches to understanding what motivated individuals to support Nazism. And there are various theories, some less well kind of received now than others, about the kind of the power of the unconscious mind and unconscious emotional and psychosexual drives that were forcing people into the arms of Hitler. Now, in the next podcast on this topic, we're going to look at two further philosophers, Friedrich Nietzsche and Georges Sorel, who both had key contributions to the development of fascism. What I'd like to stress here is that unless you're talking about people like Houston Stuart Chamberlain and Arthur Gobineau, very few of the intellectuals we've talked about here advocated anything like fascism. Obviously, the likes of Charles Darwin, their work has been the foundation of all modern life sciences. And there's very little in Darwin that you could argue is in any way applicable to fascist ideas. But that doesn't stop people from Chamberlain onwards, and Gobineau and Chamberlain onwards, all the way through to Hitler, cherry-picking aspects of what is being argued to support an ideological position. That's not really the fault of the science. It's really the way in which human beings use supposedly categorical, rational, scientific truths to promote kind of ideological positions. You can see not just in fascist thought, but in various different kind of ideological approaches from Marxist-Leninism to neoliberalism throughout the 20th century, the idea that they are ultimately grounded in scientific understandings of the world. The economic models created to predict human behaviour and to optimise economic benefit for human beings purport to be scientific pictures of how humans interact. And there's a whole field of writing and thinking about this, the kind of the rather chaotic and often bloody interactions between scientific arguments and scientific enlightenment rationalism and extremist political creeds throughout the century. If you're interested in more in that, check out the videos of Adam Curtis, the documentaries of Adam Curtis. They're particularly a good source of a kind of ideas on that. So we're going to continue with the development of fascism over the next few weeks. I hope you find this useful and interesting, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thank you. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.